Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here in an undisclosed location with Adam McQueen, Helen Lewis and Ian Hislop. We're here to discuss the news of the last 2 weeks, give or take, maybe even the next 2 weeks. And we start off with the fact we've got a completely new government. We've had a reshuffle.
Completely new, but largely new.
Yeah. Yes, sorry.
New. I thought it was largely the same.
Yeah.
Well, with different desks.
The funny thing was, last press day, so we're going back to Monday the 1st of September, at about 10:30, once we thought everything was pretty much done and we knew what copy was coming and nothing else was happening, there's suddenly a big BBC breaking news thing saying, Keir Starmer reshuffle kicks off. And I thought, oh my God, we're going to have to pull apart the entire magazine and redo it completely. And that turned out to be sort of, you know, the Minister for Paperclips was swapped with the Minister for Nice Biscuits with Tea and Coffee after cabinet meetings. And right. That was pretty much it, as far as I could see. So I thought we were safe at that point. At which point, I disappeared off on holiday for a couple of days. And a message from Helen to say, have you seen the news? And it turned out Angela Rayner resigned. And as you say, we had a largely new cabinet suddenly. So.
Yeah, quite a lot of changes. New Home Secretary.
Foreign Secretary. New Deputy Prime Minister. Ugh. And then loads of changes. The two ones that have been gone a bit under the radar is Pat McFadden, who is the kind of last surviving Blairite, and Keir Starmer's big fixer and sort of straight back player on political shows, has ended up at the Department of Work and Pensions. And Johnny Reynolds, who was at Business, has gone to be Chief Whip. And the really interesting thing about that is that suggests that they're going to try and put welfare cuts through again, because essentially they tried to put through changes to personal independence payments, completely failed to do so because of a huge backbench rebellion. I think that they still know that that is a big target, a lot of money. They eventually end up making changes that look like they will be net costing them money now in the welfare bill, and it's money that they don't feel that they have. So there's that's part of it. And then the other part of it, I think, is a feeling that they wanted Shabana Mahmood in at home because she's the most hard line on immigration and boats. Every day they wake up and thinking about how they're going to lose to reform, basically. Nice. And so they know that's the one issue that they've absolutely got to get a grip on is asylum hotels.
I couldn't see what new weapons, as Chief Whip Reynolds has, that the previous Chief Whip didn't have. Is it personality alone? I mean, why should the backbenchers put through any reforms this time that they didn't want last time?
Johnny Reynolds is famously very, very nice. For many years, he used to send me a Christmas card with all of his adorable children in matching sweaters. I think the Labrador may even also have been in a matching sweater.
So think they've basically gone from bad cop to good cop?
I think they may be trying good cop. Right. But I agree with you. The way I see it is that lots of these Labour people think, well, you know, I was elected in a Northern English seat or a Welsh seat. I don't think I'm going to win it next time. Do I want the one thing to come out of my 5 years in Parliament to have been taking money away from disabled people? So I think they will still struggle to make that case with backbenchers. But they obviously are trying to, you know, put people in that they absolutely feel they can trust. There's been a lot of stuff happening in the back room as well, just to try and make that number 10 operation. And, yeah, they brought back Tim Allen, I'm sure friend of the magazine.
Yes.
I was going to say, if you're a dictator, then there was only really one person to call. Which is interesting to me, because I think one of the problems that this government has is they don't really understand what the media is now. they're still wedded to the idea of the 6 o'clock news bulletin or getting something on page one of the Telegraph or whatever it might be. I think they're beginning to realise that they really need to be on places like TikTok, where Nigel Farage is absolutely massive. And James Lyons, who has left recently as government communications advisor, said this in a LinkedIn post. He said, you know, it's changed massively even in the time I was there, and I still don't think we've really got to grips with what it's like to try and make our case in this this environment.
That was something that struck me with Shabana Mahmood as well, who, as well as being kind of the most kind of hardline kind of and socially conservative person, was also, in terms of effectiveness, I was thinking the last really sort of big success they had in selling a story to the public was the very awkward situation they were left with the massive prison population that was going to explode. And she, very successfully as Justice Secretary, managed to sell that back as, you know, this is a mess, we were left by the Tories, and this is what we're going to have to do to get over it. It's not ideal for anyone. That was the last time I can remember this government feeling sort of quite sure-footed on something and communicating it quite well.
And using an amazing technique known as honesty, which, you know, is worth a try occasionally. We have to let these people out because there isn't room for them. We don't want to. We hate them as much as you do. Mm. We don't want to see them coming out and being picked up in jags by their old mates and having a glass of champagne, but we haven't got any cells. I mean, that sort of worked.
Yeah, I mean, it was a potentially government ending moment, wasn't it? That sort of imagery, and somehow that one did kind of pass and paved the way for new disasters thereafter.
The other interesting one is that Steve Reed has ended up going to housing. Now, he is, music to my ears, a little bit on the build baby build side. And I think they realise that target 1.5 million homes is something they're going to be judged on. I mean, there is a housing theory of everything about what's wrong with British politics. And if you look at something like asylum hotels, that's a very good example of it, right? Actually, where are we going to put people while they wait for their claims to be processed? There's two problems there. No places to put them. And it's huge backlogs in Home Office processing. So anything that can address housing is going to make everything else across all their other policy areas easier. The massive fall from the so-called Boris wave of immigration to this year's immigration figures, it's something close to halved. I mean, it's, you know, they have actually kind of gone, oh no. And I'm trying to work out why Boris Johnson let that happen. Was that an ideological thing? Or did he just be ready to be shocked here, simply just do something he didn't really understand the consequences of?
What do you mean, carelessness and inattention to detail?
It seems unlikely, I know.
I don't think so.
But it was always going to be a lump in it, as it were, because of Ukraine and Hong Kong, which both added substantially to the stats. And I believe I'm right in saying that the backlog, people waiting for their claims to be processed, is substantially down.
Yeah, and NHS waiting lists have fallen a bit, and they have seen off a reasonable number of strike threats, not the tube strike threats that are happening as we're recording this. But it isn't actually quite as bleak a picture as you might initially think, although I'm currently feeling quite pessimistic about it all.
I mean, if that backlog has come down, and I think it's by a decent chunk in, what have they had now, 14 months, the question then becomes, does that matter? Or is the debate about immigration, boats, housing, flags, all of that now so dominant and so toxic that even results don't make a difference?
Well, also, they just lack the ability to punch Nigel Farage. Stephen Bush, my former colleague at the New Statesman, said this. They're planning to run the next election against Nigel Farage as a fear message. Do you really want this guy to be Prime Minister? Because lots of people, for everyone that does, there's someone that doesn't. But they won't tell you what you should be afraid of. And so there's this mad situation when he said, well, look, I'm going to return people because we'll get out of the EHCR and I'll return them to Afghanistan and I'll pay them. And people went, you're going to pay the Taliban. You're going to give money to the Taliban. And they kind of couldn't really land that point, right? That this guy is so irresponsible, he'll give money to people we've said are jihadists and terrorists and misogynists.
And it's worse than that. You'll pay money to the Taliban to murder people who were on our side briefly during the war.
And this is the kind of thing I think that a kind of government comms operation ought to be able to make a little bit of hay out of. But they can't. They just kind of can't quite get there on reform.
But it's the problem with blaming the government comms office. Just a way of, as is always true in British politics, of saying, well, the advisers aren't much, the comms aren't. Could the leaders do it? The members of the cabinet? I don't know.
Well, we should say what's brought this whole reshuffle on in the first place and, you know, say a sad farewell to Angela Rayner. Probably an au revoir, I imagine.
Can she stand again for deputy leader? That's something I haven't seen anyway. Could she just... I was talking about the threat from the left and who might stand for deputy leader. Could she just put herself up for it again, having resigned?
I think technically she could. You have to get a certain number of either CLPs or trade unions and MPs. There's this kind of two-step process to show you've got a reasonable amount of support to winnow people out. There may be some bit in the rule book that says you can't do it immediately. In the same way that Kemi Badenoch's most favoured line in the Conservative rule book is that you can't have a leadership challenge within a year of the new Tory leader getting in. There are a lot of people who are showing a suspiciously high high level of interest in the Gaza situation in a way that suggests that they are about to imminently announce deputy leadership bids. I'm looking at you, Emily Thornberry and Stella Creasy.
Remember Suella Braverman resigning from Liz Truss's government and then coming back immediately to the same job as Home Secretary in Rishi Sunak's just like a couple of weeks later?
But are we saying, A, that people's memories are short, or B, that they just don't care? So if you're judged to have behaved very badly and badly enough to have to resign from the second highest job in the country, that doesn't mean you can't come back. I mean, it suggests you've done something wrong in the first place,
the record,
which you haven't, obviously, because no one has ever done anything wrong at any point in any government.
The record on people being brought back is not a brilliant one, is it? I mean, you might remember both Peter Mandelson and David Blunkett had resigned from Blair's government and were both brought back fairly rapidly to other jobs. Do you remember what happened next? Oh, yes, both of them then had to resign again, didn't they?
So. But Lord Mandelson is now with us. Always.
Like the poor, he is always with us, isn't he? Yeah, no, he does just keep bobbing back up to the surface of the pan, doesn't he? It's extraordinary.
I'm going to say that I'm quite sympathetic to Angela Rayner on the basis of someone who has to do a tax return. I don't understand any of it. I don't think anyone can understand our tax system.
I'm not sure anyone does. I was thinking about this. Is it the most boring reason for a political resignation ever? I mean, absolutely, she had to go. She'd gone against the Ministerial Code of Ethics. I'm not disputing that at all.
So what was it?
It was so technical. Right? As I understand it, she went because she'd failed to seek further tax advice as recommended by lawyers on her stamp duty obligation on buying a second home.
Yeah, and then lied about it and then tried to throw the local conveyancing firm under a bus. She was the minister responsible for housing. So when, for the second time in 6 months, you are involved in a housing purchase scandal, you just might think, I'd better ask someone who knows about this, or I'd better take the safe route and pay the maximum amount of tax rather than the minimum.
Both good points.
Just suggesting.
No, but also, this is the government of the ironic resignation, isn't it? And you get your anti-corruption person having to resign for corruption.
Well, that's what I was going through. I mean, in terms of absolute slam dunks, they do kind of stay on topic with all of their resignations, don't they? So we lost Rushanara Ali just a couple of weeks earlier, the homelessness minister. She had to resign after evicting tenants and putting the rent up, while specifically trying to push through the renters' rights bill through Parliament, which banned exactly that sort of behaviour. We had Tulip Siddiq, who was the Treasury Minister who was responsible for fighting financial corruption, accused and now, in fact, on trial in absentia in Bangladesh for financial corruption connected to her aunt over there.
Yeah, auntie corruption was her brief.
We had Louise Haig. That was an undisclosed conviction for fraud when her mobile phone turned out not to have been stolen and she'd just gone on upgrade to an iPhone instead. Now, that wasn't connected. She was Minister for Transport, so that wasn't entirely connected to her brief. But slight irony in the fact that she was working for an insurance company at the time.
You wouldn't say you were Deputy Prime Minister and there'd been all these series of scandals and enforced resignations going on. Wouldn't that make you slightly more careful?
You would think so, wouldn't you? Yeah.
And the charge of recklessness, does that not hold?
Oh, I think it absolutely does hold. I'm just saying it's the technicalities. It gets slightly lost in the weed. I mean, the fact that it took kind of 2 weeks. It was more than 2 weeks because we had the scandal last year, didn't we? When we had the home in Stockport or Stockton, was it?
Yeah, original.
Yeah, and I remember the Mail on Sunday going into 2 pages of forensic dissection of Instagram photos of her sofa cushions, which was supposed to prove whether or not it was the... I mean, that's the thing with scandals. It's quite hard. When they're very, very straightforward, like the ones we've just mentioned, it's really nice and easy to make them stick. But some of them, it's just sort of a lot more complicated, isn't it?
But again, the overall optics, which I believe comms departments call this, is someone who shouts Tory scum and spent a huge amount of time having a go at the other side for corruption and tax avoidance just should be a bit more careful.
That's the damned it. You're right. She was straight out of the traps on someone like Nadim Zahawi, for example. And there was a lethal moment at a Prime Minister's question when Kemi Badenoch said there was something mentioned of her being the minister responsible for housing, and everyone groaned. And as soon as you become that sort of punchline, the government would never be able to say anything about housing. As on, you know, if the second thing is everyone groans, I thought that exemplifies why she did have to go.
Now, all this is leading up to a very exciting thing, which I know you've prepared, Adam, which is a brief quiz about some of the most technical and abstruse reasons ministers have ever had to resign. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
We're not doing the big sex scandals here.
Nope.
We're doing the really kind of slightly tedious workmanlike ones.
Can I say that Ian is looking very confident about this?
These are the ones I like.
Yeah.
We have mentioned Peter Mandelson already. So not the first resignation. That was an absolute slam dunker. If you remember, he failed to disclose. It was housing again, wasn't he? He failed to disclose something that might seem relevant to certain certain people. He owed £373,000 to another cabinet minister who he was working with across the table, which he'd used to buy a very, very expensive house in Notting Hill.
Wow.
That's why he went that time. But as I say, he was then brought back to the cabinet. Can you remember why he had to resign the second time?
Hindujism, rather, passports, right? He was involved in helping to get passports for a couple of people who were Labour donors and industrial tycoons.
And at this point, ahead of the private eye lawyer, I jump in to say that at the inquiry into it, he was cleared of any improper involvement in trying to source that passport. But yes, it was. And it was all tied up. Do you remember why it was felt that he owed a favour to the Hinduja family?
Had they set up a mushy pea factory in Hartlepool?
No, I'm afraid it's even more timely than that. It was the Millennium Dome. They were sponsors of the Millennium Dome, or a zone in the Millennium Dome. Yeah, indeed. Boris Johnson promised to lie down in front of bulldozers to stop Heathrow's third runway.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So ahead of a parliamentary vote on exactly that subject, which minister resigned from Theresa May's government on principle so that they could vote against the third runway?
Was it Zach Goldsmith?
It was not.
I've now got to infuse my brain with the time that Michael Gove either locked himself or got himself locked in the toilet on his first day as chief whip, which I thought is a way to get out of a vote that you don't want to do.
But Boris Johnson flew to Afghanistan.
He did indeed.
In order to have a meeting.
In order to not be in the country so he wouldn't have to vote. Yeah, yeah.
Who resigned?
I'll give you a clue.
For audio listeners, Adam is doing jazz hands.
Jazz Hans's brother. Poor old Greg Hans. No one remembers him at all, do they?
Still nothing.
For Chelsea and Fulham.
I would never have got Greg Hans from Jazz Hans.
I was thinking, like, was there someone who was in a cabaret at one point?
Yeah, I think he's the jazziest member of Theresa May's government.
I think Nadine Dorris, she seems like she might have done
that
Jazz Hans.
Morton.
If this section does actually make it onto a visual one, can I say that's the worst charades I've ever seen.
Now do Greg. Do a concept of Greg.
Sounds like.
Hey, that's very good.
Yeah, no, go for that.
We could have done that.
Okay, so he resigned on principle.
Yeah, he went ahead of the vote. And right. Boris Johnson just scuttled off to Afghanistan, giving rise to a memorable private eye cover. Can you remember?
It was with a translator.
Yeah.
And I think the joke was that it wasn't the third runway, it was a turd runaway.
That's the one.
Brilliant.
It's the finest tradition of Catullus.
I mean, can someone explain to me why this dramatic reshuffle in which Yvette Cooper becomes Foreign Secretary and David Lammy becomes Vice President, or no, that's his friend. But why is this going to help?
Well, a change is as good as a rest. I know the answer to this, which is because if you listen to the Keir Starmer interview with Matt Chorley, we are now in phase two. This is it, phase two of the Starmer government. You may have not noticed the passage of phase one, but the idea is that basically they're now going to try and put people in to do things that people like. I know. I don't think it's going to work.
If that was the plan for this to be phase two, though, I come back to, again, that reshuffle that they had a few days before it. Why didn't they do it then if this was the grand plan all along to move everyone around?
My hunch is that they had all this ready and they planned to do it after party conference, because everyone will be preparing their speeches for party conference, and now you've got a load of people just, you know, who are going to have to give the biggest speech of their life as a minister. And something they only sort of swatted up on 10 minutes ago. So I think this was all like in the offing, and then in a way they decided to kind of take the advantage of the crisis.
In terms of resignations, though, I mean, a lot of the speculation before he had to do another reshuffle was, yes, the Minister for Paperclips had changed, but he'd put in all these sort of very, very good economically minded people to undermine Rachel Reeves. So there appeared to be some point to that procedure, and then suddenly we're told, no, Yvette Cooper, who's been just in the Home, she's going to Foreign Affairs, is she?
But I think that was a kind of face-saving thing, because actually she was being moved out because they never really got along with her. I think they followed the, you know, kind of, you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all.
But it does seem an odd move then to put her in charge of the foreign affairs of the entire country, doesn't it?
Matter,
I mean, that's traditionally one of the big jobs, isn't it? One of the big offices.
It's not anymore, though, because the Prime Minister just does it. Who flew over to the White House to sort out the Ukraine situation? I mean, it was Keir Starmer last week. Mm. That's the thing. And that's why David Lammy's got DPM, is that, so that he, as you referenced, and he can continue his fishing-based bromance with JD Vance. But basically, she's got a kind of a job that involves her going and sort of shaking hands at boring summits and not really driving a department in the same way.
It's not like it was in the good old days when Liz Truss was Foreign Secretary.
Think of those trade deals. Think of all those great trade deals we made.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There was probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Right, so Reform had their conference, their annual conference. They had the huge Birmingham NEC, massive, great conference centre, very, very big. It all happened over the weekend. I'd just like to know from the three of you where we are on the ancient timeline of first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Because I think we've had the ignoring and the laughing at.
Mm. I think the laughing at can coexist with the winning, unfortunately. That's what I mainly took away from that conference, is that Farage has been spending a lot of time with Donald Trump, and he's obviously learned a lot about the American right-wing style, which is camp as absolute knickers, but also incredibly successful in electoral terms and, you know, enacting a lot of its policy agenda. So you get a situation in which, yes, it is objectively very funny that Andrea Jenkins comes out in a catsuit and sings a song that she has composed herself, mm-hmm. which you'd normally think was the attitude of a fringiest of fringe parties. But it was a heavenly professionalised conference. It really was. As you say, a big audience, big attendance, you know, loads of bodyguards sweeping around the place, you know, stalls, all the exhibitors, things, all the things you would associate with a main party conference were there.
And the fireworks. I saw a quote from a Reform member this morning saying, yeah, we had fireworks. You won't see Labour or Conservatives having fireworks on stage, will you? And I thought,
right.
Oh, good, clearly you're ready for government then. Right.
But that's what Trump has kind of learned. Like, those rallies are sort of slightly like WWE cage matches, right? There's all people like dressed up in stuff, and like there's a whole kind of pageanty aspect to it. And I have to say, as someone who's attended many party conferences, it's not unwelcome that someone might try and make them slightly entertaining. Do you remember that Theresa May speech where everything went wrong and the thing fell off the back and she got the throat sweet and the person got the P45? Reform's conference, although it was objectively delulu in some ways, was a lot more professional than that Tory party conference when they were in government. Wow. So I think you can over-egg the laughing at them. We might have to one day laugh at them as they do stuff and they win.
And they unveiled Nadine Dorries as their secret weapon, their new recruit, architect of the online safety bill, which they are now hugely against.
But no one's interested in consistency, Adam. I mean, Farage literally said, we're going to deport everybody. And someone said, well, you did say a few months ago that wasn't possible. He said, no, I didn't. Mm. And he did. Mm. I mean, it's literally there in black and white in the last issue.
As we said, the Trump playbook, isn't it? Yeah. You just go fake news. Didn't happen.
But fess up, Adam, because you secretly love Nadine Dorries and her column in the Mail.
She is a magnificent Daily Mail columnist. Yeah. I'm not going to knock her abilities at that at all. I mean, what I was interested in, the justification for bringing her in, because a few people there's some rumblings going on in Reform, aren't there, about bringing in lots and lots of ex-Tories when supposedly they're saying they're useless and they're going to replace them. The justification was that they actually need people who've got experience in government and know how to do it. Which is an odd justification for getting Nadine Dorries in, because she wasn't exactly the sort of greatest performer in
and she wasn't Home Secretary, as I remember.
No.
Or Chancellor. She was Minister of Culture. No. Was she not?
During which her big quest was to privatise Channel 4, something that was abandoned and hasn't happened.
Yeah, right. And she didn't know the details of who owned Channel 4, which you may remember.
Exactly, all over her brief, was she?
I sort of thought she had already gone to Reform. So I don't
you're
know
just
what
the head of the news.
She definitely left the Tories. I mean, she's written two entire books, which poor old Helen has read, about how awful the Tories are and how they're being run by an unelected cabal of rabbit murderers.
Don't you think that Boris Johnson at some point might go reform or try and go reform, which would be fascinating?
Well, this was Nadine's plaintiff
today.
But that's because this town ain't big enough for the both of us. I mean, that's the thing that's kind of fascinating to me. If you're Boris Johnson, you still harbour some hopes for comeback. You've just got to think, where could I just pop up back again? Where's what I just felt about that reform conference is that the political momentum is all with them. So they've now got a Daily Mail columnist on their side. They've got GB News on their side. They've got the Telegraph on their side. For their voting base, those are the places that you would want. Who still likes the Tory party brand? Absolutely.
Sarah Vine, page in the Mail on Sunday saying, although I deeply respect Nadine in that way that all Daily Mail columnists actually absolutely definitely do because they're all best friends, she said she thinks she's wrong about this and the Conservative Party still has some life in it and Kemi Badenoch is a marvellous thing and she will be sticking with the party of the man she divorced quite recently.
Someone wants a peerage from the Tory party, is what I'm hearing there.
Well, like Nadine.
Yeah.
But the aim, as far as I understand it, of the conference this weekend was to show, firstly, that it's inevitable. Mm. This is just going to happen.
Yeah.
To get used to
don't
it.
Don't fight it.
Maybe in two years, if there's an election for no reason that I can fathom there would be. Okay. And the other was to show that this is no longer the Nigel show and we've got lots of talent waiting in the wings and this is a party you can see putting in a cabinet of 20 MPs.
20 human beings, real human beings.
Yeah.
Yeah, the second one is a lie, though. It is still the Nigel show. It's always, this is, I mean, it's not. No, basically that party does well when it's got Nigel Farage as its frontman and doesn't when it hasn't.
Right.
And I don't really see that that's changed just because Anne Widdecombe is now sitting in a big hall rather than a small hall.
And Adam's earlier point is right. I mean, when confronted by some anomaly between spending and tax that someone had turned up in the list of wishes on the back of a fag packet which Nigel had presented as some sort of agenda, he was questioned about, and he said, well, I can't answer that now, we haven't got the senior people with experience in, but we will have. And then the first person with senior experience is Nadine Dorries. I mean, that's not a big hitter.
Well, don't forget they've got your mate Jake Berry in there as well, haven't they? Yeah. You famously had a bit of a run-in with, didn't you?
I did. I had a bit of a shout-up. Okay, he's in.
It is the creme de la creme, isn't it? This is the real top Tories of the last
time. Listeners, I confess I had an argument with him about the remuneration for the post office victims, which I wasn't terribly temperate about.
Well, you can continue that when he's in government. That'll be another select committee appearance to look forward to. As for the inevitability, I think it's one that's worth taking seriously because they are high in the polls. The thing about it is, some first past the post, we always say this, notoriously hostile to new entrants. The mountain they have to climb is absolutely incredible. Can they do that in one electoral cycle when Nigel Farage is, you know, it's so dependent on him? Can you see Nigel Farage sticking with this as a 10-year project and kind of building that momentum through the next parliament? That, to me, is the kind of don't get ahead of yourself bit of this piece.
That, to me, seems the biggest hurdle they've got. It's not just that they've got to get 20 people in who could sit in a cabinet and know what they're doing. They've also got to get at least 320 electable people in different constituencies around the country to get that majority. And given, as we've been noting in both the Rotten Boroughs and HP pages of Private Eye in recent weeks, the record of the people who did get elected on that wave in the local elections and what's happened since and the number of them that have had to resign or have been caught up in really quite extreme kind of cases of racism and as recorded in the last issue and other things. That seems to be a big insurmountable hurdle that no amount of fireworks and opera singing ex-Tories is going to surmount.
Some of the people in the local councils, it's just boils down to they can't be bothered to do the job, didn't think they were going to elect and don't want to very much. And that is the other problem about government, is it's quite boring. And reform will have to learn how to do the boring bits.
That was one of the other pieces on the roundup page in HP last issue, was they've, I believe, loosened their vetting criteria, which for a party that's had as many problems with vetting, you would think might be quite... why am I being so diplomatic? Like, that's insane.
No, you've gone all host.
But they've gone bananas if they're genuinely loosening the criteria. They wrote it to their members saying, look, if you got rejected last time, have another pop.
But I think that's genuine fear, that they need 650 warm bodies and you're going to have to take in the fruitcakes and loonies and closet racists and not-so-closet racists just to have bums on seats.
That's why I just think that the obvious play from them is to try and eat alive the remnants of the Tory party with all its institutional machinery. Because the Tory party has got, you know, lots of people with huge amounts of experience of running associations, but a dwindling membership. Reform has got a growing membership, but almost no institutional campaigning memory. And, you know, fair enough, like, Nigel Farage is very good at things like TikTok, but you do still need stuff like boring stuff like contact sheets, you know, to find out who you've been around, who you like to go knocking up doors, all of that kind of stuff still does actually matter in closely fought seats.
As soon as you get in, you have that moment which they're finding in the council. It's saying, what is your policy on special needs, potholes, libraries? We're going to stop the boats. Yep. And after that?
Yeah, and that matters more in a national election, because local elections are often like, do you hate the government? Yep. Yes, no. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, it's going to be, do you think this Reform MP is going to be good for your constituency? Are they actually going to turn up to Westminster?
Well, can I ask a question then? Is it a mistake for the Labour Party to be so furiously obsessed by Farage in the same way? Is it a mistake for Private Eye to devote any further coverage to Farage? Is this helping him out?
It's a very good question, is why are we playing all of British politics on the terrain that he has decided? Mm. I mean, I don't, you know, immigration is obviously something that comes up again and again, but people are also really worried about the economy, really worried about the NHS and public services. I think the reason that Labour are being lured onto this is that they don't have a great story themselves to tell about the things they'd like to talk about. And their devout hope is that in 3 years' time, they will be able to say, well, stick with us, we're halfway through this plan and you're beginning to see signs of it happening. But they don't really think there's anything they can point to at the moment to make that case. And they just keep being dragged. And again, I say, as a media environment that follows the right-wing papers and the BBC follows that bulletin, and you always end up with that. You know, we had a new Green leader. No one gives a toss, even though they've got a similar number of MPs. And actually, there's lots of people who are disillusioned with Labour from the left and would be easily peeled away to a different party.
And the backstories of both the new Green leader and the deputy are pretty fruity.
Yes.
At least as good as the stories about Reform, but no one cares.
But, I mean, I think we are slightly disregarding the extent of the talent which Reform does have at its disposal. So, for example, Viscount Christopher Monckton, I'm sure you're all familiar with him.
Once he wrote to Private Eye to deny that he had a pointy head, and that was why he wore a bowler hat.
Interesting. Well, a few years ago, he made a speech where he warned that homosexuality is one of the four sins crying out to heaven for vengeance in traditional theology. He added,
he's doing it wrong.
I want to know what the other three are, but we'll have to come back to that. Okay.
He also called for cigarette-style warnings about the dangers of being gay.
What, on what? Gay people?
He didn't say what you put the warnings on. No, you're right. Where would you put the warnings?
On the front. You wouldn't be able to, just plain packaging and a big picture of a diseased lung.
A photo of a diseased lung instead of just some people doing YMCA or something, like a fabulous time. Yeah.
Okay, well, what about Asim Malhotra? Advisor to the US Health Secretary,
yes.
Who made the very sensible point that maybe the royal family got cancer because they'd taken their COVID jabs, and that it's all Bill Gates' fault, and that the COVID vaccine is more harmful than COVID.
Dr. Hammond, who is also a doctor, but I would suggest one that it might be worth listening to slightly more seriously, he will be addressing the subject of Reform's new brilliant medical experts.
Okay.
And that
next
was a great moment of Farageism as well, wasn't it? Because afterwards he said, well, you know, he was just a guest at the conference. And actually he'd been introduced as the man who was helping to draft Reform's health policies. Slightly awkward.
Yes, Reform said they don't endorse what he said, but they do believe in free speech.
And to be fair, he's not the only one working on the health policies, because there's also Dr. David Bull, who is the guy that was strangled by a ghost. So, you know, he'll be bringing the sensible side.
And he followed Lucy Connolly, is that right?
Yes, yeah, the convicted criminal who pleaded guilty to inciting racial hatred.
And
brought
she's
on stage by Alison
helping
Pearson.
Them with their justice policies.
Oh, yes.
Yes, her policy is release prisoners, particularly women prisoners.
That's a very sensible policy.
You can make a good case for lots of that, but it does slightly clash with the...
I think you'd probably find some other people to make that point, though, couldn't you?
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date, and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There was probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
Now we swivel inevitably towards Free Speech Corner, which is a section of the podcast that we've been running on and off, not under that name, but, you know, we covered Palestine Action recently.
Yep.
And John Farley, iReader, who was arrested after foolishly taking a private eye joke to a protest.
Your joke.
Yeah. So now we come to Graham Linehan.
Yes.
Now, and we should say there is a trial on at the moment.
We have to be circumscribed in what we can say, but there are two different cases that are being discussed here.
Can you just say who Graham Linehan is?
Graham Linehan is a comedy writer best known for things like Father Ted and Black Books, and in recent years a very prolific tweeter and gender-critical campaigner. Now, he arrived in Britain from Arizona, where he's been living, working on a new sitcom, and was arrested by five armed police, with the explanation being that all police at Heathrow are armed, and there were lots of them. They didn't really have a lot to do, so a couple of them just wingmanned it and turned up anyway. This wasn't a totalitarian show of force, according to police, but these were for... They didn't tell him exactly what it was for, but they said it's from some of your tweets on this particular date in April. And he went back and looked at those. And essentially it seems to have been, if you see a trans-identified man, that's what he would call a trans woman, in a women's bathroom, punch him in the balls. And this is being apparently treated by the police as incitement to violence against a protected group. Now, he was in town anyway in order to, as you say, attend. He's a defendant in a different trial, a harassment trial that is related to a charge of he grabbed someone's phone out of their hand and threw it on the road and had called them a scumbag and various other things. That's ongoing, and we won't hear back until
shouting back for the trans woman on the road and that.
Yeah, there was a teenage transgender activist with whom he had an altercation. Let's put that one aside for a minute because that is ongoing. We won't know until at least October about that. But I do think that that arrest for those tweets is symptomatic of something that the police have got themselves dragged into, which is basically trying to adjudicate on extremely fine lines of things that are now, quote unquote, hate speech or harassment or whatever it might be, and just work that they are ill-equipped for and they are overwhelmed by. So I went and looked up the figures. Hate speech reports, England and Wales, 2013, 41,000 of them. By 2023, that had gone up to 145,000, so it's tripled. The guy who's the head of the Police Officers Association said, we just can't cope. We're just swamped. We're absolutely swamped. In the first, there was a report in the first couple of months that came in that neo-Nazis were making vexatious complaints, right? It's just a system that is set up for people who are either motivated by whatever reason or not, or having an online Barney to try and get the police involved. And it puts them in exactly the same difficult situation as they're policing a protest, which is they're trying to pass what words mean in very contextual, febrile situations.
Like I did feel that having complained about someone holding up a private eye joke and get arrested, the fact that Graham Linehan had made a joke, clearly is a joke, and was arrested by armed police officers when he touched, and that is outrageous, and that is police overreach, and Graham Linehan doesn't like me at all and feels I've failed him in any number of ways. But on this occasion, it did seem a Voltaire moment. I mean, I find the whole grotesquely rude and toxic shouting matches between the various extremes on this hideous. But these are not arrestable offences. And when the senior police officer says, well, we are obliged to do this, we all know this isn't true. We all know that this can't be true, because when we report other offences, they don't feel obliged to do anything at all. And this involves nearly all crimes that I can think of.
Yeah. This was
apart from murder. So it is a reasonable point to make. A is the police shouldn't be there to adjudicate in what seems to be an online spat, and B, they should be doing something else. I don't think either of those points are terribly contentious.
If you're saying, if you see a member of a protected group in this environment punch them in the balls, isn't that incitement to violence?
The thing is, it's a deeply hypothetical situation. There's not a named person. It's not like go around X's house at whatever Y right. address and punch them in the face. And we know that there's case law precedent on this because there was a hearing for a trans activist called Sarah Jane Baker, who was out on licence for attempted murder at the time, who gave a speech at a protest who said, if you see a TERF, a trans exclusionary radical feminist, punch them in the fucking face. And this went to magistrates court, and the magistrate court said, no, you didn't seriously mean this, you were just seeking publicity, which I think comes back to Ian's point that everybody involved in this is seeking publicity. It's not a serious threat, not guilty.
Right.
And I think with that precedent in hand, you would say, what are the realistic chances of prosecuting someone airing a general belief that people who in their sense are doing a bad thing should be punched for it? It just doesn't seem very likely to lead to prosecution. And the problem is that it leads to these accusations of two-tier justice, that different favoured groups are treated differently. And also the thing that Wes Streeting said, which is the police should be out policing the streets, not policing tweets. And
which rhymes, so it must be true.
Very corny, yeah. But I think it speaks to, as you say, what everybody thinks is I saw that arrest and I thought, have you solved every murder? Have you solved every bike theft at this point?
But there is also this very simplistic kind of argument that's being put that anything that's said online doesn't count. And actually, you know, there are people, naming no names, who are running very, very vicious campaigns online against specific people and targeting them and making what could well be considered to be things beyond the criminal threshold. So this idea that somehow putting something on Twitter is different to shouting it in someone's face is not always the case. I mean, there are nuances in all these things, and
mentioned Lisa Connolly this episode, who got sentenced to 31 months for saying, you know, set fire to asylum hotels. Was that general?
Not a specific person.
It's not a specific person.
In her case, the Becker sentence is because she pleaded guilty and also because it happened at the time of the riots. So that's the thing. If you're saying it in this general context of things being set on fire, saying please set something on fire. That said, I think the sentence was disproportionate. It's higher than the sentence you'd get for an actual assault.
Yeah, the sentencing I thought was crazy, but it was, I mean, she pleaded guilty to it as well, didn't it? So the court are stuck in that position, yeah.
Yeah, but you're right, Adam. Behind all this is a lot of the fact that the police are struggling to catch up with the volume of commentary. Things that people would have once said to their mate in a pub now being said online. Or people who have got mental health issues or don't have enough hobbies or whatever it might be, turning into sort of online obsessives. And so I think when I was at the Daily Mail, we used to have a long strand of Leylandii feuds. Do you remember this? A great thing which people would get obsessed with boundary wall disputes. And it would start off as a minor argument about a hedge. And then 20 years later, they were sort of people putting dead cats on each other's doorsteps. All of that has moved online. And that's the bit that the police, I think, are really struggling to cope with.
There is a problem here. I mean, in the last Copy of Private Eye, we had an Anglesey councillor saying all Tories should be shot. Now, he said that was a Welsh idiom, was his defence.
It's about as convincing as Elon Musk and the pedo guy being a South African traditional insult, isn't it? Yeah.
But I think it is historically the sort of thing that people could say and it wouldn't be taken seriously then. But then various MPs did get killed. And suddenly the difference between using, string them all up, I hate them, I wish they'd all die, suddenly became something that happened in the real world.
Yeah.
So I think there was a problem for how do you police the new world where these things merge into each other. And that creates, as Helen says, a huge problem from police. But as I'm trying to agree with both of you, but on the precedents we have, there is no specific resolute line, but individual police surely must be able to use their judgment into saying, is this actually an incitement to violence that we have to worry about, or is it someone being hot-headed and ridiculous?
I think it's between 60 and 70% of trans people have reported either violence or harassment as a result of being trans. So to them, I imagine that judgment would feel very
differently. That's why it's counted as a protected characteristic.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, to them, that judgment would be substantially different.
It's very tricky, though, because the Scottish law, and the same thing has happened here, does not have sex as a protected characteristic as one of the things. They said they were going to bring in a separate misogyny law. I've always suspected it's because misogyny is just so widespread, and one person's, you get called a bitch. Is that now actionable misogyny or not? It's just something that happens all the time. And I think that speaks to the difficulty of working out what the general consensus in the population is. Mm. So the example of trans status would be, is misgendering somebody a hate crime or not? Some people would say yes, but it was came up as an issue at the trial about whether or not referring to someone using sex-based pronouns was sort of an acceptable thing to do or not. People have wildly different views, and the police are in the situation of trying to find a median ground that everyone can agree on when very obviously people cannot agree on what is offensive and what is hate speech and what isn't.
Well, I think we've cleared that one up.
It's all sorted now.
Yeah. And thus concludes this week's tour of Free Speech Corner. We'll be back next time with another look at some people you really don't want to have to support. But the Free Speech Cause means you have to anyway. That's it for this episode of Page 94. Thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed it, then why not go and get your subscription to Private Eye? Or just go into your local newsagent and get a copy of Private Eye. That's your gateway to a wonderful world of fantastic investigative journalism, fantastic jokes, fantastic cartoons, all of it. That's your local newsagent. Look up where it is and then go there. And we'll be back again in a fortnight's time with another of these. And thanks to Matt Hill of Rethink Audio for producing. Bye for now.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There was probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.